Quasi-Cerebral Talk and Tunes. This is Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM. Here's what we've got cooking up this hour. You're tuned in to Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM. We're the campus community radio station broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast on unceded stolen territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Kwikwetlem First Nations. This episode of Typically Tuesdays was produced on the unceded stolen territories of the Katsi, Kwikwetlem, and Tsleil-Waututh First Nations. And here at Typically Tuesdays, we recognize the host nations as being the original storytellers and knowledge keepers of these lands, and we thank them for their stewardship. My name is Leslie, and oh boy, we are at the end of August. You know, when I first was coming into this month, I was like, okay, obviously, as per Typically Tuesdays tradition, I gotta do something like kind of queer, kind of gay for the first Monday of August, because that's the Monday right after Vancouver Pride. Even though I don't go to Pride, I like to commemorate, you know, a little bit of the history by doing something kind of queer on that first Monday of August. And what was supposed to be just one episode about Yuri manga recommendations, like underrated Yuri manga recommendations, it ended up becoming a three-part series. What was like more recommendations and review than just recommendations. And I thought I was gonna be done, you know, because like I like to categorize Yuri manga in those ways, like who is this story about based on age, because like readership age in manga is just really important. Well, then that left like this final week dangling, and I was like, I can't have that. It feels weird. So the Yuri manga recommendations and reviews series is over for now. Technically, I'm not going to be talking about Yuri manga again for a little bit while, I'm a little bit, you know, like Yuri manga'd out. But today's episode is kind of a spin-off. As I had mentioned throughout this series, I think that categorizing boys' love and girls' love manga needs to be a little bit more nuanced, because in North America, booksellers just categorize it as queer literature, as queer comics, when it's a little bit more complicated than that. And queer comics, queer manga, I should say, is actually quite different from boys' love and girls' love. And I wanted to explore this concept by recommending a series today that I've actually recommended to a lot of people several times, and I think this is a series that a lot of people really like as well. But it deserves a little bit of a spotlight here on Typically Tuesday, specifically for this topic. And the story is called Our Dreams at Dusk by Yuki Kamatani. I'm really excited to be talking more about it. I've read the story several times, and there are a few things that I really dislike about the series, and then also some things that I quite like about it. And when you understand the way that the story plays out, the genre conventions that it's trying to not tackle, it becomes very clear that there is a really big difference between what is girls' love and boys' love manga, and also what can be considered queer. So stick around for that, because that's going to happen in the latter part of today's episode. Of course, the first part, we're going to be talking about the context of it all, where I'm coming from. And on today's playlist, pretty short one, because it's going to be a really packed episode. Mostly just like new queer music. I hope you enjoy. Bina. Here's Pierre Quenders with Ambiance. Bina.
Ndombolo mama ndombolo Tala topina kike bonanzango Eba tata Atopina zitu tala Zitu tambula malembe Zitu 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 tambula malembe Zitu Zitu tambula malembe Zitu 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 tambula malembe Zitu tambula
At your local pond. They're our largest dabbling duck, and among ducks, the most abundant species. They're the source of all domestic ducks, except the Muscovy. There's a female making herself heard. But does it seem that all the brightly colored male mallards have disappeared? By now, the male duck's need for fancy feathers to attract the females has passed. The male mallards have molted, dropping their bright green, reddish, black, and white feathers and replacing them with mottled brown ones. Changing into more subdued colors for the months of summer helps camouflage the male ducks, protecting them from predators. Come fall, the mallards will molt again and return to the colorful dandies we remember. In the meantime, while all the mallards look like brownish females, there's one way to distinguish males from females. Look closely at the bill. The male's bill is dull yellow, while the female's is orange marked with black. And watch to see which duck is quacking. That's the female mallard. Male mallards make a more subdued and raspy call, mostly when courting or greeting, or when they feel threatened. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
Welcome back to Typically Tuesdays. And let's talk right before we get into the discussion about our dreams at dusk. I want to talk a little bit about why I think our dreams at dusk is a pretty good recommendation for if you're interested in queer manga. I think that there is a big distinction between boys love and girls love manga and what we can consider to be queer manga. Listen, I'm not a media scholar. I'm not an academic. I'm not a media critic. I am just a person who happens to be queer and also a person who loves reading manga. And I have read manga for many, many, many years. I have also been queer for many, many, many years. And something that I have noticed is that in North America, there's this tendency for booksellers to categorize boys love and girls love manga as being queer or being LGBT plus. And to some extent, I really understand that because when you read the stories, they're about relationships between men or relationships between women. But I think both of these genres, boys love and girls love, they have such interesting histories and nuances that it's really important to explore those things. There's like this complicatedness to boys love genre stories and girls love genre stories. And I don't think there's like a right way or a wrong way to go about this, because of the way that media and also because of the way that identity intersect. But I think it's crucial for us to hold space for these two things. So I'm just going to be sharing some of my observations. And again, not an academic, okay? Just a person who's watched not a small number of videos and podcasts and listened to not a small number of podcasts and read some things that make me think about this. This is a topic that I've been stewing on actually for several years. I think now is the time to unleash some of my thoughts to the world. The truth is that I don't think that BL and GL, like boys love and girls love, I don't think that they should be categorized as queer literature. I think that all the time, I guess. And I think also it's notable that they are not considered queer literature in Japan either. To understand the history of boys' love and girls' love, you'll need to listen to the first episode in this series that I did, where I talk about that a little bit briefly. And I will also share links to readings and videos and podcasts about this particular subject. But what you need to understand is that, like, boys love and girls love, these two genres, they didn't begin in queer culture or queer literature necessarily, or maybe I should say in with particular regards. Okay, I should say this: their histories are not always rooted in queer culture, is what I should say. You know, I mentioned in the first episode of this series that Yuri began in this kind of like genre of literature called Class S that kind of had these feminist questions, and some of the most prominent Class S writers were themselves lesbians who were exploring these questions around feminism and around intimate relationships between women. And BL, actually, as I understand it, it kind of begins differently. It begins actually with shipping and with really manga artists, oftentimes young women, who were really interested in drawing stories and writing stories about their favorite male characters falling in love with each other. And those stories began getting popular through self-publishing. In that same episode that I did earlier this month, talking about the history of Yuri and GL, I also talk about how boys love and girls love kind of begin to get popular in the mainstream through girls' manga, essentially, through shoujo manga. And so I think we can kind of start there if we begin our discussion about boys' love, which is that, yeah, these stories actually are not written for queer men. Boys' love has its histories in being written by women for women. And you can see that when you begin to compare boys' love stories with what is in Japan considered gay manga. In the first place, boys' love stories oftentimes can be published in shoujo manga, in girls' manga magazines, whereas gay manga is published in magazines for gay men, like explicitly for gay men, that are rooted in gay culture, that are about the lives and experiences of gay men. And, you know, that's a really big distinction. And beyond that, when you start to flip through these stories, you can see the really distinct differences. Boys Love has certain genre conventions and tropes that it will use, and they are oftentimes ones that come right out of girls' manga, whereas gay manga, not so much. And you can see it in the character designs and in the gaze of the story, the way that it's written, right? You know, in Boys Love, these characters are very, very pretty. They look like a lot of the times, like beautiful young male pop stars or beautiful young male actors. And they're clean shaven, they're slender, even if they're really tall. Whereas gay manga, they depict men, like real life men, who have different body shapes, different body types. They might be bearded. They are not always sporting like this like cute little boy band mop top. They might be like, you know, wearing like a crew cut or like a Caesar or something like that. And so there's like that really big difference, right? Who are these men supposed to be attractive to in Boys Love versus who are these men supposed to be attractive to in gay manga? Obviously, people have different tastes. Not all women are into dudes who look like Jungkook from BTS. Not all gay men are into bears, but there is that kind of really distinctive difference. I've been listening a lot to a podcast called Mangasplaining in preparation for this episode, and it's a podcast about manga for people who don't read a lot of manga. And whenever they talk about gay manga and also BL, this is a topic that is often discussed. One of the hosts is Deb Aoki, who is a cartoonist and comics critic. She's a straight woman who also happens to love BL. Another host is Christopher Woodrow Butcher, who is a comics editor, bookseller, and he is a gay man who's friends with a lot of gay mangaka in Japan. And so they talk about the distinctive differences between BL and gay manga, and it's often kind of notable that this host, who's a gay man, he's not all that into BL because he knows it's not written for him. And those story genres and conventions, you know, they're not always for this like adult grown man in his 40s. A lot of the times they are written for young women. So those things are kind of a little bit more nuanced in Boys Love than it being straightforward, like queer literature, because these stories are not steeped in the lives and experiences, community, or culture of queer men. Even though they are about men falling in love with each other and having special relationships with each other. And so I want to talk a little bit then on the other side of things, on girls' love as well, on GL, this thing that I've been talking about throughout this series, because I think this is really, really important. I've mentioned throughout the series that what I've observed is that Yuri kind of exists on the spectrum from being more grounded in the lives and experiences of queer women and the issues and joys that we experience. And then on the other side of the spectrum, being solely provocative and titillating. And so I've said on the series already, you know, all of what I have recommended, I think most if not all, falls in the middle of that. And I really want to emphasize that because a lot of what would be considered Yuri, a lot of what is considered girls' love, leans really heavily to the provocative and titillating. The fact of the matter is, lesbians are just fetishized. Queer women are fetishized. We are objectified. And unfortunately, that is just a huge part of the reason why a lot of girls' love is actually just straight up pornography, or sometimes porn with plot. This was actually my introduction to girls' love, really. When I first started reading Yuri, a lot of what was available, most of what was available that I could get my hands on, was pornography. It was stuff that was like erotic and had not a lot to do with all of the colors of being a queer woman. I remember reading stories really about girls who were just doing depraved things in general and to each other, even if they were falling in love with their classmates, you know. I think it's also worth mentioning too that a lot of the Yuri sometimes that you could get your hands on that wasn't just, you know, straight up brutality and objectification, it was provocative in nature, because the romances that were featured, even though sometimes they would be set maybe in this classic, like, class S trope in, like, an all-girls school or something like that, the story would focus on the forbidden nature of the romance between these girls. It was rarely ever about the actual issues or joys even that queer women or even women in general experience. It's in seriousness, I think it's only until like the past 10 or so years that I've started to see more Yuri that has more plot and is supposed to be less provocative and titillating. It is supposed to be more about the explorations of the lives of girls and women. And I feel like there is a really big difference between, of what I've seen personally, there can be a really big difference between girls' love and comics for lesbians, because even though on that there's that other side of girls' love that's like more grounded in the lives of queer women, I have also been really, really fortunate in my life to be able to see and read lesbian magazines from like the 1990s and the 2000s that have comics in them that are really just, you know, they're just about like lesbians living their lives, essentially. I've also been really fortunate to see sometimes similar comics that are just self-published, and they are very much just about queer women being queer women, whether or not there's like a romance in there. That's not always the main important thing. A lot of the times these stories are really just about queer women trying to share a part of their life with a readership. On that, actually, I think a little bit of a fun fact that maybe adds to what I'm trying to share here is that I got into boys' love before I began reading girls' love manga. And the reason why is it goes beyond just like shame and not being ready to accept the fact that I was not into men. But it was also because what was available for girls' love at that time, just too much of it was super male-gazy. And I just could not stand it. And I was also so severely uninterested in heterosexual romances at the time that as a young girl, if I wanted to turn to something that had romance in it, I turned to boys' love. Because, one, it didn't have any of the heterosexual nonsense that I was trying to avoid. And two, even though in boys' love manga, the women are treated really poorly, they're always demonized, they were never objectified. And it was easy for myself as a young girl to read these stories that are meant for girls to project myself into one of the characters. I on the Manga Explaining podcast, they actually talk about that that aspect of boys' love, which is that female readers are often able to project themselves or parts of themselves onto the protagonists who are in love in a way that they might not be able to with other manga and may not even be able to with certain heterosexual shoujo manga. But obviously, just because boys love and girls love isn't always for queer men and women, in my opinion, it doesn't mean that, you know, queer people don't enjoy these stories. I think because these stories can be so well written and illustrated and also touch on universal topics about like pain, identity, love, yearning, it can have a potential universal appeal. And I actually think that if there are cisgender heterosexual people who are interested in reading stories that feature same gender romance, that Boys Love and Girls Love is a really, really easy entry point. It's a really accessible way to get into that, because these stories are so far removed so much of the times from the actual lives and culture of queer people. But again, all of it is so nuanced because I'm, you know, a certified lesbian, and I love reading these stories. And I know how, and I mean, I love gay manga. I love lesbian manga. I love stuff that like GL that like sits largely on the edge of being like grounded in lesbian lives and queer women's lives. But I mean, I still enjoy stuff that's like in the middle as well. I've been kind of thinking about it like this. The concept of a gay identity is one that is pretty relatively new, right? Like a lot of research, historical research has suggested this. But people just did gay things before then. I think that BL and GL is kind of like stories about doing the gay thing. But queer literature is like identifying as queer. I've talked so much at this point. I think it's really time to take a little bit of a break, so we'll just do that.
This is Bird Note. On a hot summer's day, you can watch a bird, like a crow, very, very carefully, and you'll never see it sweat, because birds don't have sweat glands. Instead, they've evolved a variety of other ways to keep cool. One of them is panting. As the bird breathes rapidly, its throat quivering, heat is carried out of the body via the lungs and air sacs. The lungs are a one-way system, so cool air coming in does not get mixed up with warm air coming out. Holding its bill open, the bird also oscillates a tiny bone in a part of its throat where there are a lot of blood vessels. The oscillations bring more blood to the area, allowing heat from the blood to dissipate. Bare skin on the legs, face, and beak also help the cooling. So do puffing out feathers, fluttering wings, or splashing in a puddle or birdbath. And soaring birds, like hawks, can simply ride the updrafts far above the ground to where the air is cooler. Closer to the ground, birds can also do what we do to avoid overheating. Keep busy during cooler hours and take it easy in the shade as the day heats up. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
Oh. chasing constellations. I've been searching for creation. Moon up high keeps passing by. Well, I have lived by the time I die. I've been following the stars. I've been following the stars. Try to keep me in the dark, but I'll be following the stars.
That was the latest by Sibby called Stars here on Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM. And I've been, Leslie, talking a lot about the difference between
BL and GL manga and what I would consider queer manga, I guess, and why I don't always think that BL and GL should appropriately be marketed as 2S LGBT plus literature. A greater tolerance of gay people in Japan has meant more opportunities for queer manga to actually become published. From what I've noticed, lots of this stuff is usually self-published online first and then picked up by a publishing house afterwards. So for example, a really popular example of that actually would be Nagata Kabi's work, who's written extensive autobiographical stories about her experiences with mental illness and alcoholism and loneliness as a lesbian. Though I would say I think a lot of what I've seen being published that is mainstream and queer, I think they still don't always carry that whole, like, this is for queer people type thing. I think a lot of the times it's written for a more general audience, typically to educate and inform, and maybe oftentimes marketed towards cisgender heterosexual people to teach them how to not be homophobic. Though, of course, you know, a lot of it is really informative for anybody who's still trying to understand their identity or just starting that journey. Personally, what I have seen of queer manga that is published in the for mainstream audiences or more general audiences carries this sort of, like, drag queen attending a corporate event during Pride kind of vibe. But, you know, I think more of it is emerging, and that's always really exciting. I mentioned, I think, in the last episode that a lot of really well-written GL that feels a little bit more grounded in the lives of, like, queer women get picked up really quickly in North America. And I think that's a little bit true of the queer manga that we see getting published as well. And so today's manga that I want to discuss, that I'm finally getting to, is one I think that, again, has actually been recommended by a lot of people a lot over the past couple of years since it has been published and then also licensed and distributed in North America. This is called Our Dreams at Dusk. It's by Yuki Kamatani. And this recommendation slash review is not going to be spoiler free. I'm going to be talking all about this series. And throughout it, I'm also going to be mentioning some of the content that can be maybe a little bit distressing for you. Homophobia, bullying, anti-gay slurs, transphobia and misgendering, death, suicide, forced outing, and also sexual harassment and assault of a minor. Please take care of yourself
as you move forward into this episode and if you're going to pick up the manga.
So Our Dreams at Dusk by Yuki Kamatani follows a small collective of people in a real seaside town called Onomichi in Japan. The people of this collective called Cats Clowder are volunteers who demolish old houses to rebuild them into better things. Among the crew are a high school student named Tasuku, who has recently begun having to confront the reality of his queer identity. But the good thing is, he doesn't have to do this alone. He's going to do it with the support and help of other members of the LGBTQ plus community who belong to this collective of volunteers. Our Dreams at Dusk is 4 volumes, and I believe it's rated for teens by their distributor. It is a pretty, what I would say, wholesome comic, despite all the things that I had mentioned earlier that it depicts. It is pretty wholesome, and I wanted to talk about it today because I think it's a really, of what is available and what I find intriguing, I think it's a pretty good recommendation for a manga that I feel really confident in saying that it's queer. It's not just like BL or GL. It is queer. The author, Yuki Kamatani, actually is a queer person themselves. They are asexual and aromantic. They also identify as gender X, which is a distinctly modern Japanese identifier for those who are non-binary. Kamatani wrote this story pulling from their own lived experiences as a queer youth, trying to grapple with their identity and also their feelings of isolation and loneliness. And so there you have this really amazing connection already to queer lived experience. One of the other things that they really tried to do, I think, that's really interesting is they tried to depict queerness in community. They do so in a couple of different ways, right? In the story, we meet other members who are LGBTQ+, and we learn about their histories and the issues that they themselves are facing. And they're not just like any type of like nebulous queer issue, like, oh, homophobia bad, oh, transphobia bad. But it's really specifically about the lived experiences that people who hold those identities will face. And so there you get this really interesting exploration about queer issues and social issues as well. I want to talk a little bit about the things that I didn't really fully like about the story before I talk about the thing that I liked the most. One of them being that there is a little bit of like this like will they, won't they romance between the main character Tasuku and his new friend Tsubaki, who is his crush. And Tasuku was forcibly outed days before summer vacation began, and he's like struggling a lot, you know, he like nearly commits suicide. And then we're introduced to his crush, Tsubaki, who Tasuku's like really, really, really into, who possibly is also queer. But the way that Tsubaki and Tasuku's relationship is depicted is just feels like so, it just feels so unromantic to me. Partly because Tsubaki is quite homophobic, actually. And I understand that like there's often this trope about how queer people hate ourselves, and so we're like, we just like are constantly bragging on other queer people. That is something that I don't always appreciate, though, in my media.
that's just a personal gripe. And I understand that Kamatani wanted to depict the ways in which people struggle with accepting their identity. I felt that Tasuku was already like a pretty good example, though, because he really does, like, he has this moment where he, after he's forcibly outed, you know, the only thing that he can do to kind of defend himself is to say horrible things about gay men, essentially, and kind of deflect. And it's really, really hard to read through. But to have another character kind of do that as well, when confronted with the possibility that he is queer, is like, I don't know, we were already there. And then just the way that, like, this supposed romantic tension is built, I don't think is all that exciting to me. I don't know, maybe this is just like a me, just like a personal thing, but I felt that it was so uninteresting and so boring that at one point I thought that maybe it was like an editorial choice, like from Yuki Kamatani's editor, that maybe they were like, nobody's gonna read this if there isn't some kind of like cute little BL thing in it. You gotta like make it like kind of cutesy and romantic, and so it's just in there. But maybe Kamatani's like, that's not the point of it, and so they decided to pull like a Louisa May Alcott and like wrote like the worst the worst romance in God's name to defy their editor. I don't know, maybe that's just wishful thinking. I just really did not think that it needed that kind of like romantic edge to the story. Though I really appreciate the way that Tasuku and Tsubaki become friends, I really don't think that there's any need to explore their potential romantic tension there. I thought it was boring. The other thing that I really actually did not like about this story is this confusion that I have around an issue that was depicted that's really quite devastating. And I think I just hated this part of the story so much that I kept like blocking it from my memory, because every time I reread this Our Dreams at Dusk, you know, I've read it several times. There is a storyline with a character named Misora. He is an elementary school student, and I'll be referring to this character by he/him pronouns, because that is how he is referred to throughout the story, and that is also how he refers to himself. But Misora likes to cross-dress, and he really likes being praised for how he looks when he is cross-dressing. There's a storyline with him in which Tasuku really doesn't seem to understand Misora's gender identity and thinks that Misora is confused as well, so takes the opportunity during a summer festival to encourage and help Misora go out in public cross-dressing. Tasuku and Misora go out to the festival, and it's only the two of them that know that Misora is cross-dressing, but Misora is getting praised everywhere. The tensions rise in Misora's story arc when, at the festival, he is molested in a crowd, and when he discloses it to Tasuku because he's in distress, Tasuku's only response is, well, it happened because you look so cute. And the reason why Tasuku says this is because he feels like he can affirm Misora's exploration of gender and presentation by doing so. You know, that's obviously really, really horrible. And in the manga, when Misora and Tasuku reconcile, Tasuku does address, like, you know, I'm sorry that I said that to make, you know, I just wanted to make you feel good. And then he also says, you know, I'm sorry that I made you go cross-dressing at this event. I was just trying to make you feel affirmed. And then it's just like this, essentially this act of sexual violence is never addressed again. And it just feels really off to me personally. I felt like it was very like, it really seemed to serve mostly as like a plot device for the growth of Tasuku's character. When, I'm not sure if maybe this is just me and the way I interpreted it, but I felt that it was actually quite horrible for this depiction of sexual violence to not also be addressed with the same weight that Tasuku's missteps were addressed. I felt that it was really, really off. And I think that was actually, I feel like personally it was really poorly written to that extent. Like, it was just handled quite flagrantly, I think. And I really did not like that. I think every time that I read Our Dreams at Dusk, I'm always shocked by how just badly that plot line is handled. And I think that I truly think I just like completely wipe it out of my memory, because it's just like, it feels so shockingly bad in a manga that otherwise I think is like tries to be quite sensitive. So I feel like maybe I just had to share that, because I really don't want anybody else to go into this manga not knowing that this happens in it, and not knowing that I just don't feel that it was handled very well. I guess another thing that I don't always super like about this manga is like some of the illustrations don't feel all that consistent. It is a very beautifully drawn comic, but sometimes you'll get like a character who randomly has a head that is like two times the size of somebody else's head. And it's not a child. It's like two people who are like basically adult age, and they have like vastly different head sizes. So that can sometimes stand out. Otherwise, it's very beautifully illustrated. Kamatani cites the work of Moto Hagio, who is like a legendary shoujo manga artist, who explored throughout her work themes around loneliness and pain and yearning through BL storylines, and also through really gorgeous metaphorical illustrations. And so it was really great to see that kind of homage being painted in this story as well, in terms of the visual aesthetics of it. But here's my favorite part about Our Dreams at Dusk, and ultimately why I think it's if people are interested in reading a queer manga, knowing the stuff that I have complained about already, why they should check it out. I mentioned that it does a really good job of like depicting queer issues and members of the queer community. One of the things that I really love about this story, though, is that it is set in a small seaside town, and the members of this collective of queer people are multi-generational. And so that shows a couple of things, right? That queerness can exist anywhere, and that there are lots of queer people, lots of different types of queer people who exist anywhere. But that it also shows that queer people exist at any age, as well. Our protagonist is a high school student, and the story is obviously like for teenagers to read, basically. But I think like it is really amazing to see this character interact with people of various different ages. You know, Tasuku kind of becomes like this older brother figure to Misora, who's an elementary school student. But he is also taken under the wings of multiple characters who are in their, like, I don't know, late 20s and 30s. And one of the characters who frequents the lounge, who's a mainstay character, he's an older man. He's, like, got this, like, big fluffy white beard. And he's been with his partner for 30 years. In that sense, I think there's this really interesting play around time and generations, in that the adults at Cat's Clowder have gone through a lot of the hardship that Tasuku is experiencing and will experience in his life, and they've come out the other end, and so they can kind of like model what it is for him to live a queer life. And at the same time, there's also this glimpse into the queer future, sort of, and a question of how Tasuku is going to be able to model those things as well for a younger person like Misora, and how Misora has that kind of to look forward to also. You know, despite the really poorly written sexual assault storyline, as I had mentioned,
one of the things I also really appreciated about the manga, and I don't know if this is what Yuki Kamatani had intended, but the character who really ushers Tasuku into the collective is the lesbian character, Daiichi. And it's really cool to see that kind of like depiction of a lesbian character being a really strong advocate for the community. And I have to say that when a manga is able to ground itself in queer experiences and queer community like that, to be able to show the reader that there is a life for you wherever you are, and there are people who will be there with you wherever you are, there will be people who will guide you, and there will be people for you to eventually guide, that is a very heartwarming and I think also affirming thing for a lot of queer people, especially younger readers. And I think this is a really notable way to go about exploring the lives of queer people in a way that feels really lived and dignifying. If I were to give Our Dreams at Dusk by Yuki Kamatani a rating out of 10, I think I would give it like maybe like 8 out of 10. I really have to dock points for that plot line with Misora. Really, I really gotta dock points for that. It's horrible. But the rest of it is pretty amazing. And I really think that, you know, if you want to read a manga that is, in my opinion, like queer manga, you should check it out. I have talked a lot about manga the past couple of weeks, so I think I'm gonna put a lid on it and let it be for a little bit. Our Dreams at Dusk isn't even my favorite queer manga, if I'm gonna be honest, but I think it is really notably good, and it's worth checking out. So please consider giving it a read. You can pick it up at your local independent bookstore. You can like order it. And I think also I've seen copies of it at several public libraries in the Greater Vancouver area. So go check that out as well. That's Our Dreams at Dusk by Yuki Kamatani. Thank you so much for listening to today's Typically Tuesdays. Thank you so much for following the series about
manga recommendations if you've been following it. If you're interested in hearing more about manga and you've missed the rest of the series, you can check it out at cjsf.ca. It's all up in the archives. This is definitely a topic that I will be revisiting, but not quite so soon, because, oh my god, it's been a full month. Again, thank you so much for listening to the series and for listening to Typically Tuesdays. We're going to close off today with one final track, probably of no surprise, because this series has been so gay. Here is a great song from a very gay album. This is Forever is a Feeling by Lucy Dacus off of her latest full-length record of the same name. I've been Leslie here on Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM, and I will talk to you very soon.
Close behind, we were cheering.